Hey, hey, beer fans. Welcome to Experimental Brewing with Denny and Drew. I'm Denny Kahn.
And I'm Drew Beecham. Together, we're the authors of Experimental Homebrewing, Mad Science in the Pursuit of Great Beer, and Simple Homebrewing, now available at all your finest retailers. Now, between the two of us, we have over 50 years of homebrewing experience. I'm the guy known for weird beer and strange ideas, and it's getting strange today.
Yeah, it is indeed. I'm the guy who's known for questioning the conventional wisdom and seeing if I can find out what's up.
Or a new way to screw up.
Yeah, well, I excel at that.
All right, so on today's episode, we're going to get into the pub and talk a couple of interesting little news stories that we found, including some stuff about hops, before we head into the brewery to go talk about, well, those mistakes that we've made and the weirdness that we've created.
Indeed. But before we do any of that, take a listen to this message from the people who make the show possible. This episode of the Experimental Brewing Podcast is brought to you by you, our listeners. Go to experimentalbrew.com to help support us. Click on the Patreon link to donate whatever amount you like to the podcast and our charities. Click on the Brew Your Own Magazine link to subscribe to BYO. Or click on the AHA link to join the American Homebrewers Association. Part of the proceeds from those will go to help support the podcast. And thanks for your support. Welcome back, and thank you all for making this show happen. Drew's got some announcements to start off.
Yeah, first, if you haven't checked your show feed, I don't know why you wouldn't have, there was a new episode of the Brew Files just recently all about making the French 75. You've heard Denny and I talk very much and ad nauseum about Ale Song Brewing and blending, and in particular, their French 75-inspired Saison. And so we sat down with Matt and talked about how to make the French 75 and what to consider when you're trying to make something cocktail inspired as well.
Yeah, because they do it great.
Yep. All right. And then don't forget, you can support the podcast by leaving us a review in Apple Podcasts. You can click the AHA or BYO links on the website and by going to Patreon and pledging a buck or two or more to our charitable cause, which for this part of the year is...
It is the Great Pyrenees Rescue Society. We got into this because my dog, Britton, is a Great Pyrenees, and she came via these people. And these are big dogs, so, you know, a lot of people who get them can't really take care of them. So they take care of these dogs. They find them a forever home. If you ever thought that you might want a fluffy white dog the size of a small horse sitting on your lap, which they love to do, this is the dog for you.
With the texture of a cloud.
Yeah, kind of. It depends on what time of year it is and if they're wet or not. I did find something interesting, though, recently. Their coat is specially made to shed dirt, so you don't need to ever give them a bath. How about that?
Well, there you go. But you do got to brush them out, and there's a lot of fur to brush.
Yeah, there's that. You'll end up with white dog hair all over your house and everything you own, I assure you.
It's a condiment.
Yeah, that's the way I'll look at it. While we're talking charities, too, I want to remind you that due to you folks, we were able to contribute $1,122 to the National Disaster Search Dog Foundation. And that's great, helping those people out with those dogs that were going to help us out in turn in bad times. So thank you all for your generosity, and please keep it up, and we'll send some on to the Great Pyrenees Rescue Society.
And don't forget, our occasional guest host, Britton, will absolutely appreciate it.
Yeah, that's right. Every once in a while, she'll pop into the background barking her thanks.
Yep. There we go. Now it's time for something to drink.
Yeah, I think so. We're going to head over to the pub. We'll be back right after this. The 7th annual Pink Boots blend from Yakima Chief Hops is now available in homebrew sizing on the Yakima Chief website. A portion of the sales will be donated to the Pink Boots Society in support of its mission to provide educational opportunities to women and non-binary individuals in the fermented and alcoholic beverages industry. This year's Pink Boots blend consists of Ottenham, El Dorado, HBC 638, and Idaho 7, with the expected sensory notes of berry, citrus, stone fruit, and herbal. Place your order today at yakimachief.com/pink-boots-blend and brew your own Pink Boots blend beer. Hey, we're back, and we are sitting in the Experimental Brewing Pub at the corner of Everywhere and Nowhere, somewhere in cyberspace. And we are drinking, well, I'm having a beer. I'm not sure exactly what it is Drew's drinking.
Well, as I've made clear before on the show, my job with the Maltose Falcons is I'm the Grand Hydrometer, which I love the title.
I know, that's great.
Yeah, it's the Beer Education Officer. I'm the guy who leads the style discussions and all that. If you're surprised by that, what? But I also try and broaden their education and broaden my own at the same time by branching out into non-beery topics or beer-adjacent topics. And so this time I decided to do something completely different with them. Unlike previous times when I served them nothing but non-alcoholic beer and nearly got drummed out of the club for that one. This time I decided, since we live in Los Angeles, and Los Angeles has such a large Asian population from all around Asia, so, you know, lots of Chinese and Koreans and Vietnamese and Japanese here, we also see a lot of rice wines, and all of those cultures have their own rice wines. And so I went and I grabbed a selection of rice wines. Now, obviously, there was a fair amount of sake, which is what I think everybody thinks of when you say the word rice wine, or phrase rice wine, and the one, though, that absolutely blew my mind, and I am trying to get them on the podcast because I want to talk about this, was a product from a little brewery in Brooklyn called Hannah, and it was their Hannah Magoli Taku 16. I think that's how you say that.
I'm glad you said it because I wouldn't.
Yeah, I mean, look, I barely can pronounce English. But the Magoli is basically, sometimes in English it's referred to as drunken rice. It's really, it's a farmer's rice wine. It is a homemade product that sort of sits somewhere in that comfort zone between beer and soju in the Korean, I think they call it sul, which is just basically Korean alcohol. But this Magoli is almost akin to a Nigori sake, if you know Nigori. It's cloudy. It's cloudy, milky. This stuff is 16%, which is the reason why it's Taku 16, and it is sweet, it is creamy, it's got all of these wonderful fruit flavors in it that we don't typically think of in a lot of American products, so a lot of melon, a lot of cantaloupe, for instance, in the one that I had, and it was just, it was a fascinating beverage. It was completely different than most anything I'd ever had before. And so Hannah is, like I said, in Brooklyn, and it's run by a woman who, she and her family used to make Magoli just as like one of the things the family did. And when she came here to the States, she wanted to start to promote it and got the idea of actually making it here in the States. So this was really, really cool. It was really mind-blowing. It was just kind of a different experience.
Yeah, a different experience indeed.
Yep, but I highly, highly recommend, if you have any interest in rice wines at all, go and seek out Hannah Magoli, and that's Makegolli when it's transcribed into Roman characters. And it's just, I mean, it's different, and it's apparently the process is not as fussy as making sake. So that's part of the reason why I want to explore, because I want to go, ooh, teach me. I want to see this.
Yeah, well, okay.
Now you.
Me? I am having a Valdu triple. They make a quadruple that I've been getting into during my recent string of quadruple tastings. And because our weather is kind of like starting to warm up and get sunny instead of cold and rainy, I decided that it was time to get some triples. So I picked up one of theirs. It is just absolutely delicious. It reminds me a bit of my favorite Westmalle triple, in that it's more phenolic than estery. It may have just a touch more body to it and a touch less bitterness, but it is still a wonderful, wonderful beer, a great example of the Belgian triple style. So if you're a Belgian freak like me, and especially if you like triples, this is one you should find, and I think it's fairly widely available. I don't think you're going to have too much trouble finding it.
Yeah, I mean, I can find it down here in L.A. I think the thing I've always liked
Valdu. Come on, yeah, but how about Colfax, Iowa?
Well, I mean, what can you find in Colfax, Iowa except for cows and corn?
Yeah, that's true.
And actually, I'm only assuming that. Sorry to the people of Colfax, Iowa.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm sorry. I'll be back there in a couple months. I'll check and make sure that there's something besides cows and corn in Colfax.
But no, like, I can find it. I mean, actually, it's the weird part. We've talked about it before in the podcast. Like, it is very strange that we cannot find as many Belgian beers down here as we used to. I think ever since Shelton Brothers shut down and that, the whole picture kind of went sideways. And then the market's changed in terms of people wanting Belgian beers. It's gotten harder and harder to find a classic like Valdu.
Yeah, it has. Our good beer store, the Bierstein, had cut back on their selection. Fortunately, there's a really good grocery store supermarket here that has started increasing their selection, and with different things than Bierstein has. So actually, the overall selection has expanded, and I'm really happy to see that.
You lucky duck. Yeah. All right. So here we go, from Valdu and Hanamagoli over to the news, shall we?
And we're starting with West Coast IPA. You've heard us mention before that we have talked to Mr. Doug Piper, who runs a great YouTube channel called Gourmet Brewing, about a number of things. And recently, Doug asked us to sit down and talk about West Coast IPA. So we did. And you can hear it. And I'm sorry, but you can also actually see us.
Yeah. Well, hey, look, I think the funniest part about it was that Doug tried to keep us on topic and focused.
I know. Poor Doug. He was really trying to keep things focused, but you just can't do that with us.
Yeah. So go and listen to that on his YouTube channel. We'll probably be bringing the audio into the show as well, just to have as a audio-only show here. So keep an eye on the feed as well. But again, we'll include a link to Gourmet Brewing on YouTube in the show notes. And from West Coast IPA, we go to Extra Pale Ale.
Ooh.
So Firestone Walker has announced that they are releasing a brand new beer. It's going to be an Extra Pale Ale, or XPA. Now, for me and my point of view as a long-term craft beer drinker, XPA feels very much like a throwback to about 1999-2005 era. Because back then, you know, that was before people decided, oh, we're going to make session IPAs and all that. But IPA was already becoming popular, and people made these paler and paler pale ales that were designed to emphasize more of the hop character and show off kind of like the hoppy goodness like an IPA, but without the strength that's going to put you in the dirt, right?
Right.
And so that kind of disappeared into session IPA, and then, of course, the great IPAification of everything sort of took out XPA as well. Now, what I'm curious about is looking at Firestone Walker's press release. They say here, XPA is the number one craft beer style in Australia, and it's something we're excited to champion here in the U.S., and that's from Matt Brindleson. The appeal of XPAs is obvious. They offer everything you love in a good pale ale at a crushable ABV. We fell in love with the style during our travels to hop farms across Australia and New Zealand, and we were inspired to make our own. Now, so the way that sounds to me is that XPA is not the same as what I was thinking. You know, it's not in my American craft beer mind. And I would love to hear from our folks down in Australia and New Zealand Wait, what is XPA to y'all?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that just really isn't clearly defined at all. It can be whatever a brewery wants to call it. Yeah, I have yet to find one that I felt was actually balanced. I'm afraid that the ones I've tried tend to me, the body is too thin and the flavor is too weak to stand up to the amount of hops that they put into them. But, you know, that's my opinion.
I think that's actually the point of them in a way.
Oh, I agree. And that's why I'm saying they're just not to my taste.
Yep. All right. And so, again, anybody down there in Australia or New Zealand want to chime in and tell me what the heck an Australian or New Zealand XPA is?
yeah, please.
I would love to get educated.
And if you brew one, please send us your recipe so we can take a look at how it's put together.
There you go. All right. And then from a style that may or may not be new or recycled or something completely different using an old term, that never happens, right?
No.
We go to an old brewery that's been revived. Y'all will have known that we are big fans of Narragansett beer. I have all my New England roots. My grandfather drank Narragansett all the time.
Well, Narragansett is a killer summer lager.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, to me, it's like Red Sox and Narragansett. You know?
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
That's summer for me. And, of course, the brewery got revived after going away in the 80s. And we've talked with Lee Lord, who is the head brewer and, I don't know, I guess best way to put it is like director of brewing operations and R&D. And I forget what her exact title is, but it's something in that nature.
Yeah.
But Lee got a really great write-up in Pellicle along with the brewery. They both got a great write-up. And we'll include a link to that in the show notes, but it's always really great to see somebody who's a good person like Lee go and get some positive attention out there. And like I said, I don't know how my grandfather would react to Narragansett making things like Hazy IPA, but he'd be happy to see the brewery back.
He'd probably like the porter, wouldn't he?
I imagine. He was a home brewer, too.
Oh, and, so.
Well, the funniest part is I never knew my grandfather was a home brewer until well after I started home brewing.
That's amazing. Runs in the family.
My mom used to complain that he would ferment the beer in big crocks with cheesecloth on top, secured with rubber bands, right? We all know that old-fashioned style of brewing. And that her clothes that she wore to school every day always smelled like yeast. She was not a fan.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine so, man. When you're a kid, that kind of thing can be a real stigma, huh?
Uh-huh. All right, so we go from XPA and Lee now to questioning about hops or some such.
Yeah, right. And I think we've probably touched on both of these topics before, but I'm going to talk about an article that I've been reading in the Hop Queries newsletter that the amazing Stan Hieronymus puts out. You can find it at hopqueries.com. You can subscribe to it so it shows up in your inbox every week without having to go out and look for it. But back in January, Stan wrote about reports coming in that the number of hop acres, the number of acres growing hops needs to be cut back dramatically, according to Tom Davis, who's the CEO of John Haas. He claims that an additional 9 to 10,000 acres of aroma hops need to be removed from production in addition to the 6,000 acres that were taken out of production the year before. Apparently that 6,000 acres did nothing. So farmers in Washington, Idaho, and Oregon are going to need to cut back by probably at least 10% the number of acres of hops they're growing. Eliminating 10,000 acres of hops would be like eliminating all Czech hop production. It would reduce the hop acreage grown in the Northwest to about what it was in 2015. And, you know, the problem is that there are just too many hops out there, and the price of them has been plummeting, which, you know, you may not believe if you've been going to your homebrew shop and buying hops, but it's true. And for all the nice things that may be for us people who are buying the hops, let's not forget that these farms are businesses and they have to make money. And if the price of hops plummets, they're not going to be making money. And eventually, we won't be able to get hops at all. So this is a very interesting thing. And the Hop Queries newsletters in general have a lot of really great, interesting information. Lineage of hops, assessments of the aroma and flavor impact of different varieties of hops. I would really encourage you to go to hopqueries.com and read through whatever catches your fancy while you're there. You might even be able to do it while you're listening to us.
Yeah, and again, it, as Danny said, you can subscribe and get a weekly newsletter, because I do. And I will tell you that the articles range from very much kind of on the surface, that the things are very easy to understand, to what?
Yeah, I was going to discuss an article that talks about the genetic distance between different varieties of American and European hops. And I had about like only about a 5% understanding of that until I read it through about 8 more times. So we're going with hop production instead.
There you go. So that's San Jeromas's Hop Query?
Yep.
Or Hop Queries?
Hop Queries, yes.
And we'll include a link to that in the show notes. In the meanwhile, I'm going to finish my Magoli, you finish your Valdu, and then let's get back to the brewery.
All right, we'll meet you in the brewery in just a minute. The ultimate all-in-one electric home brewing system is here. The new Grainfather G40 can produce up to 11 gallons of beer and features all the latest advancements in home brewing technology, including wireless control so you can monitor your brew day from the Grainfather app. With an innovative new grain basket design that improves workflow, reaching mash efficiencies of 75% or more is easy. The 3,300-watt heating element brings your wort to a boil quickly without any scorching, and the large hop plate filter guarantees that no unwanted grain matter or hop tube reaches your fermenter. Every G40 comes standard with a high-powered built-in pump that can handle temperatures over 200 degrees Fahrenheit and a full 3-year warranty that guarantees that you will be able to keep on brewing no matter what. The new Grainfather G40 is available now at your favorite homebrew retailer or online at grainfather.com. Welcome to the brewery. The fermenters are bubbling away despite our best efforts to dick chimp the beers that went into them.
And the glycol chiller is buzzing.
Oh, yeah.
You might be able to hear that.
Good on you. Yeah, I can kind of hear that back there. I recognize it. Sounds just like mine. So, Drew, what have you been brewing?
Well, I've been up to a couple things. One is, y'all remember last month I did the happy hour. That was our 100th happy hour, and it was both hybrid, so it was virtual and in person. And y'all, in person events are tricky. I could have used Denny there to help me with the audio, but oh well. But no, it was great fun, and the folks at Lawless were great hosts. So always good to see that, and it was really great to actually have that opportunity to taste Tom Fontes's New Zealand Pilsner, which if you want to find out more about, you can go listen to the Brewfile show that was just released on that a little while ago. But it was good beer, so good opportunity. Next up, we're doing Sage Bistro, a plant-based bistro and brewery.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and they operate L.A. County's only organic hop yard.
So a plant-based brewery, is that opposed to the meat-based breweries?
Funny, you should mention that. You know, it is funny. I'm going to get into it a little bit with them later this week when we have the happy hour. Because by and large, beer is a vegan product. You know?
Right.
Because even vegans don't have a problem with using yeast. As long as you avoid isinglass and gelatin and chitosan, you know, pretty much most of the ways that you would make beer are vegan friendly. So I'll be curious to see what they talk about when I ask them that. They do also do everything with organic ingredients.
Right.
And that'll be something else I'll be interested to see is just how much improved the organic ingredients are. Because back in the day, organic ingredients were interesting. They were expensive. And they weren't quite as good. So that's the happy hours for you. But in the meanwhile, I've actually been brewing because Southern California Homebrewers Festival is coming up and I have to have beer there for some strange reason.
Yeah, well, we'll see, huh?
Yep. And so I've actually brewed two different things and tomorrow I'm brewing the third. And the first one I brewed was my corn malt cream ale. So y'all will remember I've talked about that before. I love cream ales, particularly as we're getting warmer. And this one, this time I'm using Irex Pilsner and Emergent Yellow Corn Malt. And we'll see how that goes. You know, the hops are pretty simple, just Magnum Willamette. And that is currently bubbling away right now. It's on its rise up. Yay, go ferment.
Yeah, especially because that wasn't an easy beer, was it?
No, that one was fine.
Oh, that one was, huh?
That one was fine. That's
right. It was the Clam Chowder Saison.
Yeah. So day one, I brewed the malted corn cream ale. Day two, and it just went fine. Day two, I brewed the Clam Chowder Saison because you people voted that I had to use clams again. 9 years ago, Denny and I brought this abomination into the world.
That's right.
And now I'm bringing it back in just because why not? It's funny to think that was 9 years ago. But yeah, so while I was brewing the Clam Chowder Saison, which again is my pale Saison formulation with mashed potatoes in it, so instant flaked potatoes, no dairy, as part of the adjuncts to the thing, it gets, what, a light hop addition, and then the final final knockout stand is where things start to get a little weird, because I add into that thyme, salt, black pepper, bay, and the star of the show, an 8-ounce bottle of clam juice with clam pieces.
Hooray!
Mm-hmm. Now, just so you all know, I'm not completely an apehead here. I did make a double batch of this. One half of it is currently fermenting right behind me in a little jerry can cube because I basically took it off hot, put it in the cube, let it sit down, and it's now fermenting away with Y yeast 3711, and it's going to become a Earl Grey Saison, and the Earl Grey is currently steeping in some vodka in the kitchen. Try not to drink that. The Clam Chowder Saison is on its rise right now up to 68 with 3711 in there, and that's just going to go into the keg as is. But I will tell you, this, for all intents and purposes, despite having had a perfectly calm and clean brew day the day before, was anything but. Because, reader, I made mistakes. And
yeah, just to let you guys know that we're not perfect, and I think you already knew that. But
yeah, sometimes it's a good reminder that, yeah, we're kind of special idiots, too.
Yeah, that's right.
So, first things first, when I was assembling my G40, I forgot the bottom filtration plate. You know, the thing that keeps things out of the pump?
Ooh.
Yeah, and I got into the mash, and I got about halfway through the mash, and I realized, that's the bottom plate that's sitting over there. And I had already been running the pump, so I'd already been pulling things through the pump, and of course, you know, in that initial bit, stuff got, you know, knocked out of the mash tun and down, and so the pump got clogged. Good job, Beecham.
Yeah.
And so I had to work some magic in order to get the pump unclogged and get it flowing again. The other thing I forgot is I had a nice, long, leisurely lauter because I didn't put any rice hulls in the damn thing.
Oh.
And remember, the beer itself is like Maris Otter and Pilsner malt, which, yay. Oat malt, which has a lot of husk material, but also the oats are kind of gluey a little bit. Wheat malt, which has nothing. And then mashed potato flakes, which basically turn into glue.
Yeah, right, man.
And so that was a very long and slow lauter.
Did we use hulls the first time we brewed it?
I think we did.
I don't remember.
But also remember the first time we brewed it, we also brewed it in my big cooler that had that big military grade cables at the parade.
Right, sure. That would take care of it.
Yeah. So I think we got away with a little bit of forgiveness from that thing. So all I can say is, one, because of the amount of shoveling around of grain that I had to do, hot grain, and the amount of shoveling around of hot wort I had to do in order to clear the pump, this beer is anything but a low-dough beer. However, I do remind myself that this is also a farmhouse beer, and nothing is perfect on the farmhouse.
There you go, man. Great way to look at it.
Yeah, so that was a bit of an adventure, and boy, howdy. It was the most volume I'd ever done on the grandfather, and again, on the G40, so nominally 40 liters, right? Yielded out just a little over 10 gallons. Just to get that split down. There'll be far less of the Earl Grey Saison than the clam chowder. But still.
Well, we'll
what
see.
A day.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Well, and for the first time, I'm actually going to be there for the Southern California Homebrew Festival. So I'll get a chance to try Drew's beers.
That's right. Well, you actually get to speak there. And so you'll have a chance to have that, both versions of the Saison, the cream ale, and then the mild that I'm going to make tomorrow. And the mild is my classic mild, but I'm trying to think, I feel like I should be doing more than just one beer out of the thing. but I can't really think of a good add-on to the mild, like how to make the mild into something else.
You could add a whole bunch of more grain to it, or some extract to the second runnings, and do a brown ale.
I could. My other thought was, or you know, flip it and do a brown ale, and then the second runnings a mild.
Yeah.
Or take one portion and add a bunch of invert syrup to it. You know, something like that. Yeah, I'd had a couple of those thoughts, but nothing really zinged me yet, shall we say.
Yeah, right. Well, we'll see what happens by the time you get there.
There we go.
I don't think you can do a normal brew, so you'll have to do something.
Yeah, well, yeah, I got to learn something every time I do this. And and don't forget, if I'm learning something, it doesn't matter if I screw up the beer.
Yeah, right. You can keep telling yourself that.
Are you kidding me? I've been telling myself that for 25 years.
I know, man. I understand completely, because I had a similarly challenging brew session. I was making a German Pils, right? Summer's coming up. Time to get a German Pils going. And I have been using Rar Old World Pils malt lately. And the beer's been coming out a bit hazy, especially chill haze. So I thought maybe I'd try an actual protein rest this time through, since, you know, it's high protein. So I thought I programmed my grandfather with 125 degree protein rest before going on to the Hawker's schedule at 145, 158. But I kept screwing it up and having to stop the session, change things, restart it. And eventually I must have like really confused things so much that I ended up with no protein rest at all. And my strike temperature was 155. It's like, whoa. So anyway, I waited till it cooled down. Didn't get the protein rest. That kind of threw me at the beginning. The rest of the brew seemed to go fairly well. The wort was looking just beautifully clear. Hit my pH. Everything was great. And I got down to ready to transfer to the fermenter. I usually just pump it all over using the pump in the G70. And I had gotten that sucker so airlocked that I could not get anything to go through the pump. Now, normally I would stop and consider this carefully and come up with some sort of solution. I did come up with this. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm going to object to that. Having known you for as many years as I have, I think you have a higher opinion of that than I think is real.
Well, you know, I have recovered, like that time I forgot all the hops in the German Pils, right? You know?
It's yes.
Like, yeah. So I can recover, but this time it was just like, oh, crap, what am I going to do? The wort was sitting there at 203 degrees. I grabbed a half gallon plastic pitcher and started transferring it a gallon or two at a time into a plastic bucket and climbing up the steps to my fermenter, which sits up on a table, and dumping it in. It's like I did that 4 or 5 times, you know, just putting this like wort just off the boil, treating it extremely roughly. I mean, this is going to be the ultimate test of hot side aeration, let me tell you. And then, of course, as soon as I got done doing all that, I looked over. I saw my jaded hydra sitting there. I saw my Blickman Riptide pump sitting there. I could have cooled it with the hydra and then pumped it over with the Riptide. But did I? No. I did the idiot dick chimp thing. So we'll see. Tried to use my glycol chiller to cool it down, and it seemed to go fairly well. But after about 3 hours or so, I realized that with the fermenter all sealed up, it was going to take forever to cool down. So I cracked the lid on the fermenter a bit too. So who knows what fell into it from my garage. Once it took about 4 hours to get it down to my 55 degree pitching temperature. Put in a couple packs of S189, started bubbling a few hours later. We'll see. I did try to dump the tube yesterday and found out that there was so much crap in there from my scoop and pour method that I had just locked that sucker up totally, even when I put a bunch of pressure on it to try and push the tube out. So I guess I'll be racking it off the top this time when I keg.
So a couple thoughts.
Yes.
What is it with you and German Pilsner and making mistakes?
I don't think it has necessarily anything to do with German Pilsner. I think it has more to do with age and just spaciness.
Well, okay. And then the other one is, yeah, see, at least for me, I could say, hey, this is a farmhouse ale, so no Lodo. Somewhere out there on the internet, there are the low oxygen people going, he's destroyed a German Pilsner. It's the hallmark of why you want Lodo.
Yeah, well, that's true. And I was just glad that I hadn't done the whole brewing process Lodo, only then they end up there, you know? So, you know, we'll see if it's going to be any good or not.
Well, once again, just a reminder, malted barley wants to become beer.
That's
even
right.
When we make mistakes.
Even if it's going to be bad beer. But the upside, the other side of the coin is that the rye Doppelbock that I brewed a few months ago is into lagering now, and it is showing a lot of promise. I think that one could be actually a pretty good beer. So I can do it.
Well, I know. It's just like how I had the perfect brew day with the cream ale. Actually, the only problem with the cream ale is it came in a little bit high on gravity. Oh, darn. and the next day, you know, when muscle memory should right be there and going, I completely screw up everything. So, that's life. Man.
I know. Well, it's when you get overconfident by going, well, I got this. And it's like, no, you don't, idiot.
Well, yeah, particularly for me, I'm like juggling the dogs, juggling my job, juggling the brew, juggling this.
Yeah, right. Okay, that's enough of that. We just wanted to let you know that we screw up probably even more than you do. So, and if you have a truly, truly impressive screw up, please write in and let us know. See if you can outdo us.
I still think the most impressive one we had was the person who said they melted their linoleum.
Yeah, I kind of like that one too. I have to admit that we haven't gone quite that far yet.
Yep. But hey, let us know.
Yeah, right. We'll see. We'll laugh at each other. Okay, we are going to head over to the lounge now and talk to Jason Barker, a brewer who won the Midwinter Madness competition that my homebrew club puts on. So stick around and we'll be right back. The next generation of countertop home distillation systems is here. The all-new AirStill Pro from Still Spirits is a revolutionary still that will look right at home alongside your everyday kitchen appliances. This small-batch 2-in-1 distillation system operates in either pot still or reflux mode and allows you to craft high-quality light and dark spirits at home. No hoses, no complicated assembly, just plug and play. The AirStill Pro column cools itself with a built-in high-powered fan. The Still Spirits AirStill Pro is available now at your favorite homebrew retailer. Learn more about the Air Still Pro at stillspirits.com or check them out on Instagram, Facebook, or YouTube. It's just about time. It's just about time. Don't you think it's about time? We talked about beer. So come on in. Come on in. Just come on in. And pour yourself a beer. Okay, this is the part where everybody sings. Beer, 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 beer. Beer, 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 beer. Beer, beer. Welcome to the lounge. We are going to be talking today with Mr. Jason Barker about his Belgian Golden Strong Ale recipe that won the Midwinter Madness competition here in Eugene.
Yeah, it's a Belgian Golden Strong, so think your thoughts of Duvel and Perrot and all those beers like that, and what makes it different from a triple, because we even get into that.
Yeah, that's right, and I have some addendums on that afterwards, too, so sit back, relax, grab yourself a beer, unless you're driving, and take a listen. Hey, everybody, welcome to the lounge. We are being joined today by Mr. Jason Barker, who does a bunch of cool things in the brewing world that we'll be talking about. Hey, Jason, how are you today, man?
Good. Hi, Denny. Hi, Drew.
Howdy.
Thank you for taking your time to join us. One of the main things we're going to be talking today, though, is how Jason was the best of show winner at a moderately good-sized competition that my club runs called Midwinter Madness. But before we do that, Jason, let's talk a little bit about your brewing background, man. How long have you been brewing?
About 13 years. I picked it up and started at it like most of us do.
You started off with the extract kits and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah. Yep. I completely messed up a brown ale kit and made some syrup and just kept at it. Actually, I started making wine. I assumed making wine was easier, so I bought a kit, bought all the equipment, and put it all together. And then the last line of the instructions said something like, let it sit for 6 months. And I go, well, wait a minute.
Yeah,
what, six, right. What? So I go back down to the homebrew store and said, what do I do in the meantime? He goes, well, make beer. I go, no, that's too hard. He goes, what are you? You're stupid? What's up? And so I go, I had a bunch of misinformation, I was assuming. And so I made beer in the meantime, and the wine turned out horrible. The beer's been doing good. So that's how I got going.
Well, never forget the old vintner saying that it takes a lot of good beer to make good wine.
That's right.
That's very true.
I've made wine a couple times, and I agree. I don't have much patience, so that's why I generally stick with beer and probably drink it before it's ready too. So, So the recipe that we're going to be talking about that you won Midwinter Madness with is like a Duvel homage. I don't like to say clone, because I don't know about you, but I can't even clone my own beer, let alone somebody else's.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. And you've been working on this for a while, right? You've been brewing this recipe for a while?
Yes. That style, you know, a Belgian Golden Strong is one of my favorites. And several years ago, I started... You know, when I started making Belgians, mine always came out way under attenuated and sweet, and I couldn't figure it out. So it kind of became a rabbit hole to really go down a certain style and really figure out what are they doing? How do they make this way? And so it became one of those, I am not making another style of beer. I am going to make this over and over again and until I get it right. I don't think you ever get it right, but you get it, you know, satisfactory to where you like it, you drink it, and then you get validated when you win a competition with it.
Yeah, your cut's from the same cloth as Denny.
Yeah, man. It's like, you know, I not only brew the same recipes over and over, but when I go back through my notebooks, I find that even without trying, I end up brewing them about the same time of year every year, too. Just must be when I just get a taste for something in particular.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so cool. So I'm looking at your recipe here, and you got I'm not going to convert this into percentages right now. We'll do that when we put it on the website. But you're starting with 17 pounds of Pils malt, a little bit of acid malt, and 2.3 pounds of invert sugar, which I find interesting. Mash 75 minutes at 152, which is higher than I usually go for these. And so... Have you tried this with like other sugars than invert?
Yes, I think I've tried just white sugar, you know, just cane sugar. I use invert only because I make it myself, and for my Belgians, the darker styles, I'm usually making that dark invert sugar. So, you know, I do that a lot anyway. And I make it invert to make it shelf stable. This recipe, you know, you wouldn't necessarily have to make your own invert sugar. Just white sugar would be fine. I think it would probably do the same thing.
And why the unusual
You're not going for any color or any caramel notes or anything like that.
Right. Sure.
So why the unusual per weight?
Why the 2.3 pounds?
Yeah, instead of like 2 or 2.5 or 2.25 or...
Oh, that's just, just percentages where I just kind of landed on kind of reverse engineering it, you know, where I wanted my gravity to be and, experimentation and whatnot. So that's where it ended there. Now, there's nothing real specific about that. Just getting my points where I wanted them to be.
Right, and that's the way I approach it, too. I look at the percentages first and then see, what kind of weights those end up being. And if it's, say, like 2.27 pounds, when I get the right percentage, then obviously it goes to 2.3, something like that.
Yeah.
Homemade
invert sugar, too, you have a variable of how thick are you making it. Are you making it clear into rock candy, or are you making it super runny? You may have the same amount of sugar in there, but the amount of water that's dissolved into that solution is going to vary. So that's why I wouldn't really, maybe a more accurate way for me to represent that on the recipe would to give a dry sugar weight, not a invert sugar, because that's nothing I'm buying off the shelf. So, that part wouldn't be.
That's true. So 2.3 pounds of invert sugar is going to have a certain water content to it. So probably you'd have to like drop that down if you were just going to convert that to table sugar, huh? Yeah. So.
Absolutely. In fact, I can do that. I can on the recipe when you put it on the site.
Sure. You can do that. Or if I was going to do it, what I would do is I would put in all the grain first and then see how much sugar I needed to get to 1080, which is your OG,
That's
pretty easy to back calculate it too. And I thought it's interesting that you don't add any hops until 20 minutes left in the boil.
Yeah. Yeah. And not going for a super strong hop characteristic in this beer anyway, not super high bittering is needed. So I just put it fairly late.
Right. And so that's what, 4 ounces of Zotz at 20 minutes on the boil. And of course we all know that Zotz is incredibly potent with its alpha acids.
Yeah.
What are they? 2.3?
Yeah. It's pretty low.
2.3. Yeah. Right. That's just what I was thinking too. So what kind of equipment are you brewing on?
I have mostly Spike equipment. Some Blickman on a Blickman tower. So, 5 and 10 gallon batches, with a Herms setup. Uh-huh. And, like most of us, it's just kind of a Frankenstein over the years, kind of piecing together and upgrading equipment here and there, to make the styles that I like, when that's the Belgians and German lagers are kind of my two favorite styles. And so, kind of piece together a system that can make those as easily as possible. And I used to always make 10-gallon batches when I was competing a lot, but I don't do that as much. I have too much beer hanging around, and I don't actually drink as much as I used to. You know, we all kind of slow down as we get older and appreciate the one beer a day kind of thing. And so, you know, I cut down to 5 gallons. Yeah.
Yeah, right. And I'm the same way, man. I've got a Grandfather G70, right, which can do a 70-liter batch. Mm. And I usually end up doing about 6 gallons on it because that's all the beer I need at once.
Yeah. Yeah, that's quite for a bit of beer.
So have you been tempted to go to an all-in-one system?
Not really. I have a few friends in my brew club that are doing that, and I see that's a trend that people are liking. I guess I'm kind of ignorant. I don't know enough about them to know if it's going to fit what I want.
I mean, look, I never really stopped any.
I like the simplicity of it. Obviously, that sounds cool, but I also do a lot of low oxygen brewing, and so that's important to me. And I haven't researched enough of the all-in-one systems to see how good they are at low oxygen brewing.
I think that would probably be challenging, you know. And obviously, you know how your system works, and so you know there's a lot to be said for going with what you know.
Yeah. Yep. Anything that gets added to the system has to either make things quicker while still maintaining your quality. It's kind of my thing. So I don't just jump in and do something like, hey, let's just try this. You know, I'm pretty systematic about it.
That's a good way to approach it too, man. I see far too many people doing things because it's the trendy thing to do and they have no idea what they're doing or how to do it or why they're doing it. So, you know, it's good to analyze your style and do what works for you.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of a balance though. You know, you guys are known for experimenting quite a bit, obviously. I'm not as adventurous as I probably should be. So that's where kind of brewing with friends helps. You know, I'm very systematic and I brew to guidelines. I love classic styles, so I don't experiment with weird stuff very often, which a lot of people would say maybe is boring. You know, why do you always just make BJCP beers? Well, to me, they're classics for a reason. You know, they're refined over centuries and I really like them. But then I got friends that just go off the cuff on things. And as long as they execute them right, they make fantastic beers. And so, you know, I even see my own shortcomings quite a bit that I need to be pushed into those experimental type things more often.
Can you give an example of someplace where you got pushed into that experiment?
Yeah, sometimes like our club, sometimes we'll do group, I'm not sure what they call it, group brewing, team brewing, mm-hmm. where we put out a recipe and say, hey, you know, everybody make this style of beer. And you have to use this yeast and, you know, there's still some flexibility there, but it may be a style I'm not wild about, or I wouldn't use that yeast in this recipe or something to that effect, or it's rushing it a bit like, hey, let's have this ready, 10 days from now, something like that. but I go, hey, you know what? In the interest of let's just learn and see what comes out. It may not be a perfect beer for Jason Barker that I would, you know, but hey, if I teach somebody something or if I learn something, then have at it. Just try it.
All right. Well, now in that spirit of you saying, yeah, that you reiterate on these beers all the time. You said earlier that you'd done many, many runs on this Belgian Golden Strong. How many attempts did you make at this before you got to this point where you're happy with it?
It was probably about 6 times. To where I got to where I was like, okay, I'm really liking this beer. And the main issue, you know, it's not the recipe, hardly at all, mm-hmm. right? In most beers, it's not the recipe, it's the process. And for me, it was about just getting the frickin' Belgians to attenuate. So finding everything I could, every process to get it, you know, the most fermentable wort possibly can. And, you know, that's like why I'm mashing so long and at the temperatures I am and using sugar, all these things to try to get it to attenuate. That's when it kind of turned the corner, you know, when I'm like, okay. And consequently, that's helped all my Belgians. In fact, all my beers to just make them as fermentable as possible. So, yeah.
I have to admit, when I'm making, I mean, I make a lot of triples because I'm addicted to Westmalle. And like you, other than Belgian styles, I make a lot of German style lagers. And what I've gone to for those is mashing at 148 for 90 minutes. And I have to admit that that really is a great thing. It makes them what Stan called digestible in Brew Like a Monk, you know. And that's very, very important for Belgian styles.
Yeah, so then tell me this then. Since I got the Herms system a couple of years ago, the ability to start mashing really low temperature, let's just say 140, and then just slowly ramp it clear up to like 155 over the course of a couple hours. My thinking is that, hey, you're hitting all those target temperatures to let the different enzymes work. Is that kind of, you know, the same thing instead of just trying to target one temperature?
That's what I'm trying to figure out, man. Well, lately I've been experimenting with like the Hocker schedule, which is, you know, like, say 45 minutes at about 145 and then maybe like an hour at 158. And I'm trying to decide if that's really making a difference. But what I'm finding a lot is that it depends a lot on the malt that you're using too. I've been using Rahr North Star Pils a lot. Delicious malt, works really well. And for that, you know, the Hockers kind of helps for the body and the head retention some. But, you know, you can also get away with doing like a single infusion like you're doing, on it, you know, or like I sometimes do. But recently I've been working with the Rahr Old Star, the Old World Pils, and it's got a higher protein level than a lot of other malts. And I found that I was always getting a chill haze in it because of the protein in it bonding with the polyphenols. Mm. So what I'm going to be doing the next time I brew is I'm going to be starting to try the old traditional 128 degree protein rest on it that I haven't done in years and see if maybe that breaks down some of the protein more. But man, I'm like you. I am experimenting with this stuff, trying to figure out what works. But I am seeing that you have to kind of, at least I need to adjust my mash regimen depending on the malt that I'm using.
Oh, yeah, that makes
imagine sense. That.
Yeah.
Ingredients matter?
Shocker.
Yeah, right. Yeah, you know, and so, I mean, you know, that's why when somebody says, well, I got some Pils malt, and it's like, what kind of Pils malt? Who made it? What are the specs on it? Because they're not all created equal. And, you know, and I'm sure like you, I've developed some favorites through the years trying different stuff. I found, say, in Pils malt, I found some that I like better than others, you know?
No, definitely. Yeah.
So, you know, so kind do of you have thing a favorite?
Oh, a favorite Pils?
Yeah.
You know, not really. I haven't found any I guess I don't like as long as I'm staying with the name brand stuff. I do rotate in some local stuff. You know, I live in Oregon, and so there were some local Mecca Grade had a style. I just love. I love supporting local business anyway and local farmers, so I would buy theirs. And I can't remember the name.
What, are you thinking the Pelton?
Pelton
was their main Pils.
Pelton, maybe that was that.
And then they had Gateway, which was the under-modified.
Yeah, but for usually award-winning, you know, if I'm really going for competition-type stuff, I'm sticking with traditional Belgian, you know, European malts for that kind of thing.
Right, right. God, that reminds me, I have a sack of Dingemans out in my garage I totally forgot I had. Thanks for the reminder.
Yeah, dang dong.
That's a good one. I do like Dingemans, yeah.
So, Drew, what else do we need to talk to Jason about?
Well, I'm just curious because you obviously make a lot of triples. Jason, you're making this Belgian Golden Strong. looking at this malt bill, which is pils, acid malt, and the invert sugar, the big debate about Belgian Golden Strong and Triple is always, so what's different? So for both of you, I'm going to ask both of you, what do you think you need to make this into a triple? Is it really just as simple as a different yeast choice, or is there something different you're doing in the malt?
Nope. I would take this and I would use Y-Yeast 3787, the West Mall yeast, and it would turn into a triple. Or if I was to use Y-Yeast 1388, which is Duvel yeast, it would turn out like what Jason, well, in theory, it would turn out what Jason's making, assuming I had the same sort of skill. What do you think, man? Is that like a good assessment that the difference is mainly just the yeast?
I would think just yeast. When I think of a triple, I'm usually thinking a little more body. I could be off. The best triples I've made are when I've under attenuated this strong a little bit, and then I go, hey, I just made a triple. But, you know, I guess that's just going from memory. But yeah, I think the yeast would just be the biggest, you know.
That would make the biggest difference in flavor, I'm sure. So here's a challenge. I'm going to do it, and you guys should both try it too. Go get both a bottle of Duvel and a bottle of West Mall Triple, and sit down with a little sample glass of each and compare them, and let's find out what the differences are.
Yeah, to me, I always think a triple as being softer and fruitier, and a Belgian Golden Strong being kind of more hard-edged and drier.
Yeah.
By hard-edged, do you mean like more bitter?
When you say
hard-edged?
More alcoholic, more... Okay.
More of a sharp. I know, man. It's hard to describe, isn't it? Describing beers is difficult.
Yep. All right. So we got this recipe here. What else do you brew a lot, except for when you're going down a rabbit hole of Belgian Golden Strong?
Of Belgians, the German lagers are my favorites to do that. Once I got temperature control several years ago, that's what I really like to make. I like Doppelbach is kind of my big thing. And then from that, making an Eisbach, I just love that style of beer, that just malty, rich beer. And that, you know, a little bit of a rabbit hole too, because they're rich and thick, but they're not syrupy. You know, you need they still got to attenuate. And so getting into executing that can be difficult, but when you get it right, it's good.
Rich flavor with appropriate body is really difficult to do. I just made my first Doppelbach in the 26 years I've been brewing. It was a rye Doppelbach, of course. And I can see that, you know, I'm in the ballpark, but it needs more work.
Yeah, they definitely take work. But it's the same as these Belgian, you know, just getting that finer, those last few points of attenuation and stuff. Definitely do it. We all know if your system's sound, you know, if your fermentation profiles and all that kind of stuff, your sanitation, you're going to make good beer, right? It's just about those finer little tweaks. And, you know, Denny, I think you've been at it just almost long enough to kind of know that. Couple more years.
yeah, right. Well, that's why I tend to brew things over and over. Same thing when I'm cooking, man. If I don't get what I like, then it's like, damn it, I got to do this again because I just can't live with that. You know?
Exactly.
this may be good, but it wasn't what I was shooting for, so I'm going to have to try again because I just cannot live with the fact that I dick chimped it.
I've never heard that before.
Once again, a technical term on the podcast.
Yeah. That's a highly technical term. So, Drew, anything else?
No, I think that's what I got.
Okay, cool. Well, Jason, man, thanks a bunch for taking the time to join us today. If you should be down here in Eugene, get in touch, and it would be my pleasure to buy you lunch and a beer.
Oh, that would be great. I love Eugene. It's a great town, except for the Ducks. No one likes the Ducks. But that aside, it's a good beer town.
I'm not even going there, man.
Well, thank you guys for having me on. I appreciate what you guys do for the hobby in general, this podcast being one of them, but all the other things you guys have done. I appreciate it, and thank you on behalf of all us homebrewers.
Well, that's very, very kind of you. We do it because we're too stupid to not do it.
Plus, the chihuahuas have to eat.
Yeah, right. Okay, man. Well, thanks again for joining us. Have a great rest of the week and weekend, and take care.
All right. Thank you, guys. Take care.
Man, that guy is just an amazing brewer. He also won what they call the Heavy Metal Award for taking four first places in the competition. His Belgian Golden Strong was the best of show winner. And I do have one little correction, amplification to make. When we were talking about the differences between a Golden Strong and a triple, I was saying it's mainly in the yeast, but I also think that probably a triple is going to be a little bit more bitter than a Golden Strong, too, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, to me, a Golden Strong is a little bit sweeter, right? Yeah. It's that more that sweet, hot alcohol thing.
Yeah, I think Jason's recipe comes in around like 25 IBU or something like that, and Westmalle, for instance, is 39, so there's quite a difference there.
There you go. All right. Addendums to the addendums to the addendums.
That's right. And we will have Jason's recipe on the website so you can give it a try yourself. But now it is time to go to our new segment, the YE Style Spotlight, and wrap things up and get out of here. So we'll see you right after this message. When I'm done brewing, I want to be done brewing, not waiting around for my wort to cool. With the Hydra, the Corny Pillar, and the other great chillers from Jaded, I can be done when I'm done. No more waiting 20 minutes for the wort to cool enough to add Whirlpool hops. No more messing with cleaning and sanitizing counterflow or plate chillers. With the super fast immersion chillers from Jaded, you can chill your wort in minutes without all the hassle. Jaded chillers aren't just works of art. They're the fastest, most effective chillers you can buy. Check them out at jadedbrewing.com. Hey, welcome back, everybody, and it is time for our new segment, the YEAST Style Spotlight. And basically the way this works is YEAST picks a yeast and sends us some info about it, and we come up with ways to tell you how to brew that style of beer. So this week, they chose YEAST 3068, Weihenstephan Weizen. Please don't laugh at my German there. Or go ahead, laugh at my German. I guess it deserves it, huh? And Drew is going to fill you in on the information they gave us.
Yeah, all right. So the very first part is descriptions, because you need descriptions, right?
Yeah.
So their description is, for the 3068, is a strain isolate was originally submitted to YEAST 33 years ago from a pioneering Oregon microbrewery that has now sadly been lost to history. The strain became part of YEAST culture collection. Throughout the course of homebrewing trends over the decades, this strain is still amongst homebrewers' top choices. It is a YEAST bestseller, which YEAST sees as a testament to the flexibility of the strain's characteristics and the longevity of the German wheat beer style. In fact, 3068 and wheat beer strains in general have been on the rise, and 3068 is only surpassed by 1056 and 1318 in the number of packages produced. Notable breweries using this strain include Kona Brewing in Hawaii, and Bear King Brewing in Texas. I remember a couple years ago when Hazy's really kicked off, it was kind of funny. 1056 has always been YEast's big one, and then 1318 just came in and went, nope.
So we got some additional information from Fausto at YEast, who's the technical product support manager. That's the guy who helps you decide what to do with the yeast. I asked him some specific questions because I've been seeing a lot of stuff lately, people asking questions about using temperature or pitch rate to control the esters in this yeast. And so he addressed that. And here's what Fausto had to say. And again, I'm going to screw up lots of pronunciations here, so just laugh along with me. Fausto says, when brewing a Hefeweizen to achieve the bubblegum flavor and aroma, which is a yeast byproduct during fermentation by combining esters, isoamyl acetate, banana, ethyl butyrate, grape and apple, etc., and phenols, 4-vinylguaiacol, which is cloves, there are some factors involved to consider besides the yeast strain itself in order to reach the desired beer specifications, no matter if it's a home brewer or a commercial brewer. First of all, ingredients. Wheat malt contributes to higher ester production and lower clove production. Likewise, if more barley malt is used, you'll get more clove production and less esters. This is interesting because I just saw somebody asking yesterday if they could make a wheat beer without wheat. And it's like, yeah, but you won't get the flavors you're looking for. Okay, mashing schedule. A rest at 113 Fahrenheit for 25 minutes will stimulate the 4-vinylguaiacol phenol production if required, though not necessary if more esters are desired, right? So if you want more clove, do a 113 rest for 25 minutes. Aeration rate, less aeration to the wort will induce ester formation. This kind of like ties into the whole pitching rate thing, huh? Pitching rate. Under-pitching increases ester formation. He's saying 5 to 10 cells per milliliter would be a good rate for ester formation. Fermentation temperature. Knock out at 53°F and let it rise to 72 for primary fermentation. And I would bet that not many Hefeweizen brewers actually knock out at 53. Mm-hmm. Vessel type. Open fermenters produce more esters than unitanks. This I saw dramatically demonstrated when I was at Sierra Nevada about 8 or 10 years ago, and they have huge, huge open fermenters for their Hefeweizen. Just a beautiful thing to see.
And Bigfoot.
And yeah, I guess they use them for Bigfoot too, huh? For precise underpitching, and this is always the question, is like, how do you know you're underpitching? How much do you underpitch? For precise underpitching, aim for 5 to 10 million cells per milliliter. You can check out our standard pitching rate recommendations, and we will put this chart on our website so you can see it. Once the activator has been smacked and activated, you are working with 125 mils of liquid. Assuming the batch is 20 liters, 5 gallons, at 12.5 Plato to achieve 5 million cells per milliliter, then the required milliliters of slurry yeast from the activators is 83 milliliters. Basically, if you want to underpitch your yeast, after you smack the pack, it's activated, it's all mixed up, what you want is 83 milliliters of the slurry from that pack. And like I said, they have a whole pitching rate chart that they sent us, and I'm not going to try and impart that to you.
Yeah. Well, I think the right thing to think is if you want to follow Foster's recommendations and you're in that standard sort of gravity, so 12.5 degrees Plato or about 1050-ish in homebrew units, you're going to want to pitch 2/3 of a fully activated activator pack from White Yeast.
Yeah, and if you have a way to measure 83 milliliters, that's going to be even more precise. But yeah.
Right, but if you get 2/3 of the pack, you're right there in the ballpark.
Yeah, kind of hard to see, though. And because Drew and I don't brew a lot of Hefeweizen, we went to our good buddy Rodney Kibsey, who may be the winningest home brewer ever in terms of competitions, and asked him for some tips about what he does with it. Rodney says use at least 50% malted wheat and Pils malt, rice hulls to avert any stuck sparges. Right, Drew?
Yep.
And remember, the more malted wheat you use, the more you're going to be under those esters. Hops for bittering, Rodney says he likes to use Magnum because it's very clean and high alpha, and Hallertau and Tettnanger are also good hops in this style, too. Any hop flavor and aromas should be kept to a minimum, right? Because you've got all those esters coming from the yeast and the wheat. You don't want the hops kind of getting in there and muddying things up. So, there you go. The style spotlight this week is on Y-Yeast 3068 Weihenstephan Weizen yeast, and there's some tips about how to use it to brew yourself a good Hefeweizen.
So it sounds like if I want to make a more phenolic / clovey Hefeweizen, which is right. What I like, then more even split on the malted wheat and barley, so say like 50-50.
Right.
And under normal pitching rates, under an airlock, and keep it cool. Right. And also do the low temperature mash to get the more guaiacol.
Right. Do the 113 rest.
Yeah, got to get that 4VG in there.
That's right.
Right. And then if you want to make something that is on the more estuary side, the more banana bubblegummy type thing, then more wheat. So like the classic Hefeweizen being like that 70-30 split malted wheat, barley. More wheat, open fermentation. You don't have to worry about the mash temperature in the same way, under pitch, and then knock out and let rise up to get your ester formation in an open fermenter. And remember, when we say open fermenter, we don't mean, you know, like a big open tub, because we're not Sierra Nevada and we can't maintain positive pressure and keep a clean room going. We mean put it in your fermenter, slap a piece of foil on top of the fermenter. Ta-da!
There you go. Yep, just let that pressure get out of there. So, okay. Now, as if those weren't enough tips, as if we haven't already had a plethora of information to unload on you, Drew has a quick tip.
Yeah. The quick tip is, I mean, I may be one of the few people who can take advantage of this directly. But if you have a local brewery, go talk to them about their water source and whether or not they're doing a regular water report. So in my particular case, you all know I live near Wild Parrot Brewing Company. We both get our water from the exact same source, the Sunny Slope Water Company. And so, therefore, Wild Parrot's constantly doing their ward reports in order to actually be able to know what their water is across the season. So I just go in, I have a beer, and I say, hey, John, can I see the latest water report?
Well, you are lucky you can do that. And there may be a few other people out there who can do that, too. I know I can't do that.
Yeah, but in general, if you have a brewery somewhere nearby, the odds are pretty good.
Nearby being the key.
Yeah, then the odds are pretty good that you can at least generalize out. We would still recommend unless you're actually neighbors with a brewery and running through the same pipes, you should still do your own water reports just to make sure. But again, just a good little tip. Check in with your locals to see what they're seeing, particularly like here in a place like Southern California where so much of our water gets blended. So, like, we get a lot of what they call MWD water that is blended into various local sources, and that MWD water is a blend of its own. So, we have to be very careful. So, check around. Use your local breweries to get a thumb of the water or, you know, a picture of what's going on with your water. So, just a little weird tip like that.
A little weird tip indeed. Yep. Okay, and now something other?
Yep, something other. This should come as absolutely no surprise to anybody who knows that I'm a video gamer and also the how much I love 40s and 50s music, but Fallout on Amazon Prime has been released, the whole series, all 8 episodes at once. I'm about halfway through the series right now, and my biggest worry was how they were going to manage it because Fallout has a very weird tone to it. It is bright and peppy and weirdly humorous while also being incredibly dark and violent. And I am happy to say that at least in these first 4 episodes that I've watched, they actually got it right. So it's kind of nice to see a whole brand new story. It's not anything that's been covered in the games before, but a whole brand new story being told in the world where you just fire up Amazon Prime Video and go watch it. You know, you don't have to play a video game. And also the combination of the primary leads, Aaron, who is playing a Brotherhood of Steel recruit, Walton Goggins, who's playing the ghoul, and Ella Purcell, who is playing Lucy, the vault dweller. They're great. They're fantastic. They're wonderful on screen together, and it's a great time. Plus, there's a lot of Easter eggs in the whole show for those who have played the games, as I have since 1997 or 1988, if you're counting the spiritual successor, Wasteland. So,
okay.
There you go. Fallout. Amazon Prime. Go watch it. It's fun.
Yeah, I played a whole bunch of video games, but I think I was pretty much out of them by that point. So my video games were played with, like, chalk and stuff like that.
My video game was Pong, where you just yelled at each other across the way, Pong!
I just, you know, I just take a crayon and draw on my screen. That's a video game. Okay, enough of that. Thank you all for putting up with us for another hour on Experimental Brewing. You can catch all of our latest adventures and writings by going to our website, experimentalbrew.com. Don't forget, you can follow us on X, where we're at EXP Brewing. We're on Facebook. We're on Instagram. Drew hangs out on the homebrewing subreddit and the Slack homebrewing channel. You can find me hanging around the AHA discussion forum and Facebook and a bunch of other places, too. Just look, one of us will be there. If you want to ask us a question, suggest topics, recipes, experiments, or just rant and rave, you can email us at podcast@experimentalbrew.com. And don't forget, let us know about your brew day screw-ups. Or if you want to get a hold of each one of us individually, I'm Denny at experimentalbrew.com, and he's Drew at experimentalbrew.com. And we have technology you can use. You can send us a text, leave us a voicemail at 626-765. One ale. That's 626-765-1253. So until next time, remember to always brew experimentally.
Or brew wacky.
And we'll see you on the next episode of Experimental Brewing.